Welcome, Toby Edmonds, for another edition of You Ought to Know.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
How are you doing today?
You know, not too bad. It's been a good morning so far.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good. I know you've put together something, but I'm fascinated by a further development in a tale that we discussed from last week about door locks.
Okay.
And I thought I would just bring you up to date and say, it seems to me, you know, when we think about vehicles, we think about how well they drive, and then the wheels, tires. We talk about brakes. We talk about fuel efficiency, etc. But this sort of simple thing about getting into and out of your car, a lock, which used to be very, very easy. There was a lock. There was a tumbler that was usually on both sides of the vehicle, maybe in the trunk, and you put a key into it. It was a mechanical, it was an analog device. You put it in, you turned it, the door opened. And on the older vehicles of that sort, were there very many difficulties other than freezing locks, perhaps in the winter?
You know, sometimes, you know, it would kind of depend upon the vehicle, but, you know, it was entirely possible for, especially if you, you know, went through the car wash in the wintertime, you could get water down inside of in between the trim panel and the door, and that water could get down there around the lock rods. And it would make it to where you couldn't unlock the doors because it would freeze the lock rods and from moving. You know, that would usually happen if your door seals were probably not in the best of shape. Lots of people don't realize that when you're scraping your glass in the wintertime, when you're repeatedly striking at those door seals with the tip of your ice scraper, sometimes you can damage those seals. And it will allow more water than usual to get down in there, and it could freeze around the door locks. The other thing is Volkswagen went through a run of bad door latches. And even though it wouldn't necessarily prevent you from being able to manually unlock and lock the doors, what they were famous for was setting the alarm off at very inopportune times. Because it couldn't tell the difference between the door being open or shut or unlocked with the door alarm. I mean, the alarm set, not set, and that could cause a little bit of difficulties. There are quite a few different reasons as to how what would cause it to where if you stuck your key in the door lock and then turned it would either misbehave or not unlock at all. So, but you know, there's a couple of different things that could have gone terribly wrong.
Yeah, and I remember also having to adjust an older vehicle's the door closing striker plate or something to ensure that it would close easily and lock and unlock and so on. But I think the important point was to say I remember adjusting because it was relatively easy to do some of these things. And mm-hmm. and to analyze, problem solve, and so on. In the modern world, however, I've discovered that even experts, these are not simple things. Getting at a lock mechanism, first of all, it appears that, I think I'm correct in saying many modern vehicles only have one lock, if you will, that you can look at and say, that's a place to put a key. And it's connected, there's a mechanical aspect to it, but much of this has to do with electronics from a chip inside the key, which is required to be recognized by the vehicle for that key to work in the ignition. And very often, we're talking about either a combined fob key or a fob. And it's all about communication, and this is an electronic form of communication to some central point in the vehicle, which will allow the vehicle to start, and it will, it in fact, is tied into the alarm mechanism, et cetera.
Right.
And last week I described a situation where what would have appeared to be the simple locking mechanism was not operating. So having a failure of the electronic connection, just putting the key in and turning it wouldn't open a vehicle. After a considerable time, and it took a while, to take apart, was discovered that, yes, the lock mechanism needed to be replaced. But, of course, that's not a part for many cars that's readily in a parts department bin. So it has to be ordered and brought in. So I'm awaiting its return. In the meantime, the other interesting thing is that it's been discovered that one of the keys actually does communicate with the car, but won't operate the mechanisms. So we're not quite sure why, given the various ways in which a key battery works, why that is so. So that's being explored as well. Suffice it to say, it's not a simple matter of spending an hour, even if people know the system, and coming up with an answer. But the piece that was really interesting is that, and something that I was wondering about, you have a parts department. There are obviously auto parts stores. And I have seen people, when I bring a vehicle in and we begin talking about a particular need for a repair, I'll turn to a computer, and on the screen will appear a breakout of that particular vehicle and the parts, and you can see and compare and order the proper replacement part. But going back a ways, apparently there wasn't always a high quality picture breakout of parts. I'm talking about perhaps from cars 15 years ago or so. So what's your experience with the ability to identify parts, not on new cars so much, but on cars that are still around, but are a little bit older?
Well, first of all, being able to access parts diagrams, our ability to do that in the aftermarket world is fairly limited.
Ah.
There are ways that we can look at parts diagrams for vehicles, but it generally involves a separate system from the actual parts catalogs. Now, if you're the manufacturer, if you're, you know, the dealer parts department, you have all of the diagrams in the world available to you, and it's all integrated into the same system. In the aftermarket world, it usually involves a combination of a couple of different systems in order to be able to match a parts diagram up with the parts catalog, and thus being able to look at the part and get the right part. But as far as what you're talking about, as far as older vehicles go, back in the day when those vehicles were brand new, mm-hmm. You're right. Being able to look up a part on the vehicle generally involved a bunch of books.
Right.
And you would have to flip through the books to figure out which part you needed. Sometimes you had a diagram that was available to you. Sometimes you did not. Back when I started in the parts department at Volkswagen, several billion years ago, some of the vehicles were actually even still on microfiche.
Ah, wow, okay.
So you had to sit down at the microfiche computer, the microfiche machine, and sit down and flip through the different slides. And that was especially problematic for me because I got motion sickness after a while.
Oh,
ooh,
okay.
That would get very trying after a little while. Sitting there flipping through those different slides, trying to find a part. Most everything is computerized nowadays. So even trying to find a part on a vehicle that's 20 years old, I'm sure you've noticed, we actually do quite a bit of work on air-cooled Volkswagens. So even though back when those vehicles were new, you may not necessarily have been able to sit down and look at a parts diagram, a lot of it has been computerized, and you can now look at parts diagrams. So pretty much everything nowadays you can get a diagram for, or at least get something similar that will allow you to figure out how the parts interact with one another. That being said, it is entirely possible to look up a part and get the right part without using a parts diagram. Usually you'll use a parts diagram to look up a part when you're kind of unsure as to how everything fits together, because not everything is always visible when you're working on a car.
Right.
I'm sure you know. Sometimes you can see certain parts of a system, and lots of times the other part of the system is buried. You know it's bad, and you know what's going on, but you can't necessarily see how everything fits together. So that's when those parts diagrams come in very handy and allow you to see how the system works together, and you can kind of figure out which parts you need based upon the parts diagram.
Okay, well that's helpful, and I'm struck by the situation that says, okay, we're talking about a lock. One would think that is a simple thing to deal with, one of the important but relatively minor components of a vehicle. The car will, well, sometimes run without that working, right? But sometimes not. And I'm just fascinated. I'm looking forward to the final resolution on the issue of how to lock and unlock the vehicle and the options available in terms of repair when something goes wrong with that.
So. A lot of manufacturers assume, you know, when they produce these vehicles, that does have limited capabilities as far as where you're able to actually stick a blade style key to manually unlock the doors. A lot of manufacturers assume that, because I'm not going to lie, I might take one. The ignition, the lock system is a little bit more computerized than I initially wanted, for the very reason that we're talking about right now. You know, it's very difficult for somebody who is used to seeing, you know, vehicles fail after time after time after time, because, you know, that's my job. You know, I see cars when they're broken.
Right.
So, you know, I'm used to seeing the worst side of vehicles. And so when I initially got my Tiguan, I was very unsure because it did have the keyless lock and unlock feature where you could just stick your hand behind the door handle and it would unlock,
right,
or touch the exterior and it would, you know, and of course there's absolutely no way to use a key in the ignition cylinder. There is absolutely no ignition cylinder. So at first I was very hesitant because I was like, oh my gosh, there's so many different ways for this thing to fail and I won't be able to start my car. And but as time kind of went on, it became so second nature for me to use this system, and I actually saw the benefits. I mean, it's extremely, extremely nice when you have your arms full of groceries or whatever to just walk up to the car and just hit it, and it opens, and you can put everything aside without having to fumble around in your bag or your pocket or wherever you keep your key, trying to get your key out so you can unlock the doors. I mean, it's a very nice feature to have.
Sure.
But, you know, as you found out, you have to make sure you stay on top of that system and make sure everything is always working. You know, your room for error for repair of that system is not very high. You don't really get a choice in the matter when you see a part, when your technician comes to you and says, hey, you know, I'm starting to see codes for this, or hey, the battery in your remote's starting to go dead, or hey, the actual remote itself is starting to go bad, because that does happen. I mean, a remote, a fob, which, by the way, do you know what FOB stands for?
No, tell me.
It's an acronym. It actually stands for finger-operated button.
Oh, okay. That's worth that was worth the show today. Finger operated button, FOB.
Stands for finger operated button, FOB.
Very nice. Got it. Okay.
So, so when you start to experience problems with these systems, you're not really offered any sort of maneuverability as to when and how you have to repair that system. Because as you discover, you don't have any other options when it does fail. you know, for me, there's no way I cannot get inside of my car if I allow that to that system. Why can't I start my car if I were to allow that system to fail? I have to stay on top of the repairs and maintenance for that system. So really what's been removed is your room for error, or your ability to maneuver and have a choice. You know, back in the day, you know, when you had everything was still operated by that blade style key, but maybe you had a separate remote that allowed you to unlock and unlock the door. If that remote went bad, it wasn't that big of a deal.
Sure.
You know, you could still use the key. You know, I mean, yeah, you can't electronically lock and unlock the car, but to lots of people, it's not really that big of a deal. As these vehicles progress and as things change, their decision for whether or not to fix that particular part of the system has been removed, because it is so integrated into all of the rest of the vehicle and how you access it, start it, and drive it.
Right, any listener who has a Prius understands that the vast majority of Priuses, you simply touch the handle, and as long as you have your finger-operated button in your pocket or on your person somewhere, the door unlocks or locks. And in fact, you just have to pull the handle with that fob in your pocket, and the door opens because it knows who you are, presumably. On the other hand, that's you're pointing to an interesting thing. Without that, in the Prius case, I can't speak for the most modern of them, but there is still the option of a blade key that will flip out and allow you to open things up. But you're right. Internally, there is no place to put the blade. There is a place to put the fob. But all of that is a very, very different thing than what most people had been used to for so many years.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we've dealt with that issue enough. What were you going to talk about, Toby?
I was going to touch upon why getting price estimates over the phone for car repairs is not the best idea.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Both for the shop to give them and the customer to ask for them. There are some things, don't get me wrong, there are some things that calling up a shop and asking for a price on is perfectly acceptable and very safe. Things like oil changes, maintenance type work, spark plugs, 30,000 mile services on Mercedes, B services, you know, something where the price is obviously going to be set and is easily predictable. Now, most of the times, you know, as when you own a shop or when you're a service advisor, you have the understanding that when you have a customer that calls and wants a price on certain work, most of the time when customers call and ask for a price, you know, they don't have control over the situation. They don't, you know, lots of car repair procedures are very foreign to people. How their car operates is very foreign. All they know is my car's broke. I have a problem. I need help. And there are some circumstances when people call up and try to initiate the car repair process, you know, they will ask the only question that they know how to ask. How much is this going to cost me? Because obviously that is important to, you know, a lot of people. You know, you need to know how much this is going to cost so that way you can budget for it. Where you run into problems is when you have either a problem that has not necessarily been diagnosed, or it's been diagnosed by another shop, and maybe that diagnostic was not entirely accurate. Or the customer knows what's going on as far as, you know, they can look in there and see for themselves. Maybe they're a little bit technically inclined and can look in there and see what's going on with the vehicle. And then when they call and ask for that estimate and the shop actually gives someone over the phone, lots of times what can happen is when that car is actually brought in for that repair, that's when the shop discovers that, yes, the water pump is leaking, but, you know, somebody has been in there previously and stripped out a whole bunch of bolts and, you know, something wasn't installed correctly, or somebody's been in there and replaced the engine with a different style engine And even though this is still, you know, the engine that's supposed to go in this car is from a different year, and now the water pump's different, we didn't get the right part. And so, or you get in there entirely and you realize that the shop that had done the diagnostic previously was incorrect, and now the estimate has changed drastically. So really what you end up with is you end up with a situation in which the shop has to change their estimate for whatever reason. And a good shop will always notify the customer beforehand. But the problem for a lot of people is if they go in expecting one thing and then that changes midstream and becomes something entirely different. And, of course, this wouldn't be an issue if the estimate came back cheaper.
Sure.
But, you know, lots of times it doesn't. Lots of times it's actually more expensive. So, you know, you, when you go in there and you expect $400 and then midstream the estimate changes to twice that, even if the shop is entirely correct in telling you what the, you know, why the estimate's changed, you know, you're still going to be upset because you're expecting one thing and got something else. And that really is why getting estimates for unknown work, I guess as we'll phrase it, can be very dangerous for both the shop and the customer. So my best advice for you guys when you're calling up and you're asking the shop and you're trying to find out more information, I mean, the need to try and control the situation is very, we definitely understand that. You know, nobody wants to walk into a situation in which they feel at a disadvantage for getting work done on anything, especially something that you rely upon as much as you do your vehicle. But that's why finding a good shop is so important, because that way you have that relationship set up with that shop, and you can call them up and you feel entirely comfortable with saying, hey, this is what I've got going on, and you're describing the symptom rather than the work you think you need, and saying, this is what's going on. Can you give me an idea of what this is going to take to figure out what's going on? And then, of course, give me an estimate for the repairs. Because a lot of people don't know that according to Alaska state law, you have to be given an estimate for the repairs before the work is actually performed.
Right.
So
what, you know, happens, the other thing, as you were talking about this, what came to my mind was the, what might, I've heard referred to as kind of the standard time it takes to do a particular repair, quoted in hours. What if something is, for example, it's supposed to take an hour and a half for the average technician to do that work, but you have someone who is a bit newer, or you have a part that is recalcitrant, doesn't want to come off and takes a little longer to get out. How about adjustments for those kinds of factors in terms of coming up with costs?
Sometimes those adjustments are entirely warranted, and what you're talking about is book time,
right?
What's commonly referred to as book time. When you have a repair that needs to be performed, so say you bring your car in for an overheating issue, okay? The technician looks at it, and generally you will be charged a diagnostic or an inspection fee, depending upon the type of problem that it is. And then after that, you will be given an estimate for a repair. Now, when you are given your estimate for repair, it's based upon what's called book time. And what that means is the technician, and this is especially prevalent in the aftermarket world or the independent world, where you don't do the same job every single day. We are hit with a lot of different stuff. And, you know, yes, replacing a water pump is replacing a water pump, but the times and the different degrees of difficulty because of all the different types of vehicles that we deal with, sometimes the time to or the estimate to repair it is an unknown.
Right.
So the technician will go to a repair manual. There's Mitchell, there's AllData, Identifix, Motor Guide. I mean, there's a couple of different labor estimating guides. That technician will go to that book, and he'll look up the estimated labor time for that repair. Say it is 4 hours. And so the technician will turn that time into a dollar figure for the customer based upon their labor rate plus the cost of the part and any supplies. Now, that can get kind of tricky because shops will estimate out based upon labor guide, but not every technician takes the same amount of time
right.
to do particular jobs. You are going to have technicians who are more experienced and can do the work faster than what that book time allows, because that book time is based upon repair times back when the vehicle was brand new, and it's based off of averages over several different technicians doing the same job. So say a brand new car comes out, what will happen is those labor guides will time different technicians, average it out, and then that time, that average time, thus becomes book time. So sometimes you do run into circumstances as vehicles age, because like I just said, you know, those times are based upon when the vehicle is brand new. And so over time, stuff does seize, it gets gunked up, there's all different types of things that can happen. So when you run into a situation in which, you know, say you're a customer and they originally said, well, this job's going to be $400, and then they call you back up later and they say, you know what, actually, you know, we ran into this, this, and this, the estimate needs to go up, you know, are you okay with this? Unfortunately, at that time, you don't have that much of a choice in the matter. But, you know, one of two things can happen that is ethical and legit. And by ethical and legit, I mean that when, you know, a technician gets into a car, because like we just talked about, sometimes the technician can't see everything that's going on until he really gets in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we're talking about repairs internal to the engine or transmission or transfer cases, differentials, lots of times he can't see the entire extent of the damage. And sometimes it is more than what is anticipated until he gets into what's called teardown time. And that means that teardown time means that, you know, he's halfway through the procedure. He's removed all the components necessary to get down to the actual point of failure and sees that the damage is far more extensive than what he had anticipated.
Right.
At that point in time, a revised estimate would be ethical. Because it's true, you know, there's more damage. It's unfortunate, and we try our best to foresee the entire amount of damage before we get down there to get the most accurate estimate possible. But fact of the matter is, that's still why it's called an estimate.
Got it.
Because sometimes you don't really know until you get down there. So that way, we best we can do is give you an estimate for that cost. The other circumstance is, and this is something that we run into quite commonly on older vehicles, is that somebody who's not quite as experienced as us has been in there before and caused some damage.
Right.
Either stripped out bolts, broken off bolts, something that was not foreseen until we were able to get in there and actually start taking it apart and realize, wait a second, this isn't coming apart the way that it's supposed to come apart. And at that case, some additional time may be quoted for bolt extraction or tapping and cleaning up the threads of a, you know, maybe a stripped out bolt. I mean, there's a couple of different reasons. And at that point in time, once again, that would be ethical and logical.
Sure.
Now, calling a customer up and saying, hey, we need some more time for this, just because the technician maybe isn't as fast as somebody else or maybe isn't as experienced. Now, that's not on the customer. That's on the technician. That's on the shop. And that is the benefit and the drawback of working on what's called book time. Because, say, you do have a more experienced technician and 4 hours is quoted to repair the job, but it only takes him 3.5, he still gets paid the 4 hours because it is seen as a benefit that technician can work faster than what book time quotes, because he's earned that right. He's put in the years, he's put in the experience,
right.
He's put in the skill set, he's worked really, really hard, and he works really, really fast, but he's still really good. He's earned that right to you know, basically run at 125, 130% efficiency, because that's what that's called when you have a technician that is fast. Lots of times it's entirely possible for him to be over 100% efficient. Now, when you have a technician who's just starting out and is maybe only operating at 75, 80, 85% efficiency, it's naturally going to take him longer than the estimates that he's given, but that's part of how the system works. It's like I said, it's called a flat rate system, and it's designed to reward technicians for and even the customer, because, I mean, everybody wants their car back as quickly as possible. You know, nobody wants to be down that time from their car. So having a technician work on their car that's super experienced and can get it back to them faster than anticipated, you know, that is a benefit to the customer as well.
Sure.
So that's how, and in book time, for trying to explain this to, you know, it's something that a lot of shops won't do. Because when you, from somebody who's not part of the industry and they're first listening to how the system works, their first thought is, you know, that's really terrible. You know, if it doesn't take 4 hours, why do you still charge the customer 4 hours? Well, because it doesn't always work out that way, too. Because if it doesn't take, if it takes a technician, say, 5 hours instead of 4 hours, the customer still only pays for the 4 hours.
Right, right. Okay.
So sometimes it works to the benefit of the technician. Sometimes it does not. You win some and you lose some, as we say.
All right. Well, thank you. That's a very, I think that's a very useful explanation of something that, that many people encounter. Well, Toby, we've come to the end of another edition of You Ought to Know. Last comment before we finish.
If you ever have any questions or just want to talk cars, you're always more than welcome to come by and see us at Edmunds Import Auto. We are in Palmer, located across from the Alaska State Fairgrounds, and we are the shop that speaks your car's language. So stop on by, and if you, like I said, just want to talk cars, we're always here for you.
Okay. Thank you, Toby. Have a good day.
Thanks, Mike. You too.
Bye.